The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Caroline Webb. Caroline is a management consultant and executive coach who spent 15 years at McKinsey & Company. She now runs her own firm, Seven Shift, showing clients how to use behavioral science to boost their professional effectiveness. Her book, How to Have a Good Day, is an incredibly rich source of insights, storytelling, and practical advice on living a better life at work and home. She is an Oxford and Cambridge-trained economist whose work has been featured in the New York Times, Forbes, and on the BBC. Caroline, welcome to the show.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
I loved your book. And in particular, I love that you give a reason for why you're writing this book right now, because you call it a golden age of behavioral science. And this year, Second City was able to work with Martin Seligman, the father of positive psychology. We collaborated with Richard Thaler and his team at the Center for Decision Research here in Chicago at the Booth School. And we recently spent time with Dr. Charles Lim, a neuroscientist who has studied the effects of improvisation on the human brain. So I think when you talk about those three people, that's kind of like what you're talking about with this golden age, right?
Fantastic. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, there have been huge shifts in neuroscience, psychology, and economics over the last, I'd say, 20, 30 years that have really made all of those disciplines focus much more on what it takes for us to be at our best. And obviously, that means that we're much more able to apply that to everyday life rather than just in situations where people are struggling clinically. And that's exactly why I think there's so much interesting research out there that we can all use and apply in our everyday lives.
Yeah, it was really interesting thinking about the fact that all these areas of study normally emanated from a negative state as opposed to a positive state, and how crucially different that is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, for years and years, and rightly so, this is an important work that needed to be done. There was a focus on pathologies, you know, what was wrong with the human mind and how to fix it. And as you know, there's an enormous wave that took place in positive psychology. Martin Seligman in particular triggered that wave of asking people, well, what would it take for people who are fundamentally mentally healthy to be even better, to be even more at their best on those days when we're all firing on all cylinders? How do we get more of those? And it's been, I think, transformative for practitioners like me, who are coaches and consultants, working with people to help them be at their best, because it means that there's so much evidence out there that we can really be precise in what we advise people to do.
Yeah, and we couldn't study the human brain. I mean, the technology wasn't there to study.
That's right.
Right?
That's right. I mean, a huge, fMRI scanning is now decades old, actually, but before that, you had to, well, either you were cutting brains open or you were exposing people to enormous doses of radiation in order to be able to image what was going on in their brains. And so fMRI scanning was a breakthrough in being able to look at live brains in action without actually causing too much damage to the person who was actually lying in the scanner.
Right.
So, of course, that's wonderful. That really makes it so much easier for us to really understand how the brain works.
So the many things I want to talk to you about, I want to start by talking about the importance of relationships. And you start that chapter with, like, the greatest quote ever from Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman. And it reads, "Most of the great triumphs and tragedies of history are caused not by people being fundamentally good or fundamentally evil, but by people being fundamentally people."
Yeah, absolutely.
I read that and I just walked it around office to office at Second City, and I got nods, I got tears, I got laughs.
Yeah, it's quite deep in my philosophy of how I go about my life, actually, to assume that people are probably not evil, even if they're behaving in a way that's unsavory or inappropriate. Most people are not psychopaths, and it's helpful to remember that that's statistically the case. So, you know, I really find it very helpful to ask myself, if I'm encountering bad behavior, to say, what is it that could be driving this? And there's something in psychology called the fundamental attribution error, which is that if I show up to work and I'm kind of inefficient and cranky, you know, I know that it's because I didn't sleep well last night. But if you show up and you're inefficient and cranky, I decide that you're bad at your job and really not a very nice person. And that's the attribution error. In myself, I attribute bad behavior to bad circumstances. I know that it's, you know, situations that have created my falling short. In other people, we attribute bad behavior to bad character. And so that's the attribution error. And if we can just remind ourselves that most people's bad behavior is caused by bad circumstances, it's so much, well, the world becomes a much nicer place to navigate. And your reaction to those people is likely to de-escalate situations rather than escalate them.
Yeah, and I suppose the opposite is true, too, that people aren't fundamentally saints.
Well, that's certainly true.
Yeah.
What makes you say that, Kelly?
Yeah, personal experience, all personal experience. Talk about developing collaborative intentions. And that reminded me of a thing in our work that we talk about, which is that individuals need to shed the need to be right.
That's interesting. Well, absolutely. I mean, the intentions is a word that's used a lot. There's really strong science behind it. The science is selective attention. And the way it works is that your brain can only process part of what's going on around you at any given time, consciously anyway. Conscious brain has processing limits like any computer. Mm-hmm. And so unconsciously, you're filtering out a bunch of stuff that's around you. Of the trillions of pieces of data that are around you right now, you're only perceiving a proportion of them. And a bunch of them are being filtered out by your brain as being irrelevant, kind of spam. Mm-hmm. And the way that your brain decides what's important enough for you to notice consciously is essentially whatever is already top of mind for you. So for listeners who are familiar with the term confirmation bias, that's an example of selective attention, where the assumptions that you have top of mind will drive what you then perceive. And if you go into a conversation and your aim is, I've got to show them how clever I am, I've got to show them how smart I am, then what are you going to notice? You're going to notice every opportunity to demonstrate why they might be wrong and you might be right. What are you going to miss? Potentially all sorts of opportunities to understand that their perspective might have some value. What are you going to miss? You might completely blank the fact that they're trying to say something to you that's, you know, important and goes deeper than anything that you were thinking to start with. So a lot of my clients come in wanting to work on improving the quality of their relationships, and setting intention to look for points of collaboration, look for what it is that's brilliant about the person you're talking to. Once you've got that top of mind as an intention, you're way more likely to see those things in the conversation.
Yeah, it reminds me of the improv phrase, see all obstacles as gifts.
If you're
oriented towards that, and if you're in a yes and mindset, you are going to always be working with the person in front of you to move the thing forward, even if that means you're starting backwards.
Absolutely. And if you go into a conversation assuming that the person has value and is, you know, has some interesting things to say, then you're going to perceive what they say quite differently. And absolutely, that works in improv. It works in any conversation where you don't know what's going to happen next, which is, I mean, as far as I know, pretty much every conversation.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Another aspect of this that you talked about was a woman, Lauren Rivera, who was a sociologist at Northwestern University, and she found that 74% of recruiting managers at prestigious firms reported that their most recent hires had a personality similar to their own. That's sobering when you think about, you know, walking in the room. But I mean, you have a good news note at the end of that, which the research confirms that it takes very little to create a tribal sense of us. So how do you get to the tribal sense of us when you've got that level of bias of people looking to hire people who look and sound like them?
Yeah. Well, I think stepping aside from the hiring context just for a second,
yep.
we are really drawn to people that look and feel like us. Mm-hmm. And as you say, that's kind of sobering because it does explain a lot of behavior that is a bit tribal and a bit, you know, them and us. But it doesn't take very much. I mean, just assigning people to the same team has been shown to create that sense of what psychologists call in-group, which means that you're like me, and I'm now able to feel more empathy for you. And mm-hmm. you can track this in experiments. You can actually see that this happens. So it can be quite arbitrary. And that's why small talk is not small in a way. You know, when we're looking for these points of connection, saying, oh, I like your shoes, or, you know, how was the game on Saturday? What you're doing is you're saying, we have this point of connection, you and I, and therefore we are on the same team. And that's why it really doesn't, it's a very good idea to take the time if you're working with colleagues to actually look for those points of connection. And they don't have to be hokey. I mean, you can actually focus on what it is that you're all striving towards. Maybe you have nothing in common with their interests, their personal interests, but actually talking about what is it you're all in this for, what is it you're all trying to do. In the hiring context, yeah. I mean, there's so much thinking about this going on right now. I mean, the advice is really to make those initial filtering processes in hiring as blind as they can be to anything which marks out, you know, extreme. So I was actually just reading about some newer research that Lauren Rivera's done, looking at the fact that that hiring managers are drawn to fancy interests and you know, signals of high class, you know, sailing and polo and that sort of thing, if you're a guy. Mm-hmm. All sorts of fascinating things coming out of hiring as we start to really dig into these processes. But the more that you can actually focus on people's real performance and less on these extraneous signals, the more objective your hiring process is going to be.
It's funny. I was listening to a podcast that was talking about the Airbnb problems with regard to some of the bias that people have experienced. And they were talking about creating software that was actually sort of an self-anti-bias software. So it removed names and photos of people so you could check yourself.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I was actually just talking to Iris Burnett a couple of days ago, who's the author of What Works and mm-hmm. Is at Harvard. She does a lot of work on experimenting on how to remove bias in these sorts of selection processes. And she tells a story, as you may know, of orchestras and how orchestras have this issue of really the elite orchestras having remarkably few women playing. Mm-hmm. And the experiments that have gone on in trying to de-bias those audition processes, and how by putting the player behind a curtain, they got quite a long way in removing bias. But then they realized that the heels tapping on the,
giveaway.
On the floor gave it, so that you had to actually then, you know, make sure that they were either wearing flats or put carpet down, and then you got a real reversal in the implicit bias that was present.
The key to all of this is getting rid of the heels.
Obviously.
Everything. That's your next book. So given the title of this podcast, Getting to Yes And, I think we have to talk about your idea around the positive no. It took me a second because, you know, I'm all about the yes and. But you say learning how to deliver a positive no is like discovering a new superpower. So give us that superpower. What's the positive no?
Well, you know how you say yes to things because you think you should, or you said yes to something a couple of months ago, and now as time is approaching, you're thinking, oh my goodness, this was a terrible mistake. And a lot of times you don't say no, or you don't extract yourself from commitments because you don't want to offend people. I mean, you know, as I said, most people are not psychopaths. Most people care about other people mm-hmm. to some degree. We don't want to cause problems for other people. So we often don't say no, and then we're overloaded, and then we get tired, or we're doing work that isn't the work that we should be doing, and so on. So the trick is to find a way to say no that does not put the other person on the defensive. So that you get the best possible, the most expansive, generous response you can from the other person. And the trick here is to start with yes. Mm-hmm. What is it that you're saying yes to? So, for example, imagine that you've been asked to go to something next week and you can't go, normally we start by saying, I'm so sorry, I can't come.
Yep.
And the other person goes slightly on the defensive. What we do know about the defensive brain, once you've perceived any kind of threat, is that there's less activity in their prefrontal cortex. And what that means is that they're not thinking as clearly or as generously, or, you know, part of the brain that is responsible for nuanced, thoughtful behavior is getting less action. Mm. So they go on the defensive, and then they might be likely to snap back or kind of not think as well of you. Trick is, keep them out of defensive mode by thrilling them just a little with the thing that you're saying yes to. And I don't know what it is that you're doing next week that's amazing. Perhaps it's that you're building some new program and you're really excited about it, and you think it's going well, but it's taking a lot of time, and as a result, you're having to say no to a lot of things you'd love to do, and this is one of them. And by the time you get to your no, which you say, and you say clearly, I'm very sorry, there's just a little bit, first of all, more understanding. But secondly, you're landing your no in a brain that is a little bit less on the defensive, because you've actually talked about something that's mildly interesting. And I often find myself writing an email saying, sorry, blah, 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 blah. Then having to go up to the top, space, 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 and add in something which talks about the yes that I'm saying. You know, what is it that I'm doing that is exciting? And when I was writing my book, I had to do that a lot. I had to say I'm working hard on a book. It's going well. It's the hardest thing I've ever done, and therefore I'm having to make some tough choices. In fact, I ended up putting that as an autoresponder. And, you know, it just creates a very different vibe around the prioritization choices that you need to make. And since using it, you know, it's become so much easier for me and for the people I know who use it to make the right choices about where we're really adding value and, you know, where we're really doing the work that we should be doing.
And I should also note that you don't just stay in no. You actually advocate the yes and philosophy very specifically in the technique that you call brain-friendly feedback.
Yes, I do.
So
yes,
thank
absolutely.
You for that.
Same idea, really. I mean, you know, when someone's brain is on the defensive, then they're not able to think as clearly. Criticism is almost perfectly designed to put someone on the defensive, because it challenges their sense of competence and self-respect. And so, absolutely, you know, if you have something to say that, you know, someone presents an idea that you think is kind of dumb, then thinking, okay, what is the yes and here? Yes, you're suggesting that we all go abseiling this afternoon, and what would other options be? I mean, you know, just to keep it really simple, and tell me more about what's behind that idea. Just by sort of not starting with the dread word, but you just create such a different vibe. You make such a different feeling in the space between you and the other person.
Right. And this stuff is progressive. So one of the things I have to tell people is that while it's important for beginning improvisers in my vernacular to literally use the words yes and, you will rarely find an experienced improviser using those words at all. It's not that they're beyond yes and, it's that they found interesting new ways to give off verbal cues that are accepting and heightening inside a conversation. But you can't, none of them started this there. They started at literally yes and I think it's important for people in business situations to understand it's the same thing. You have to trick yourself first, or unlearn the negative or the but, and then from there you can just, you know, keep flowing.
Yeah, and I find, you know, it's really helpful when you think about the way people's brains work. You know, our brains are highly associative. If you hear your favorite song, then it will remind you of a happy time, probably, unless, you know, your favorite song reminds you of a very sad time.
Mm-hmm.
And your favorite song, you know, reminds you of a happy time because the memory is stored as a series of neuronal connections that means that it's like a domino falling. If you hear a particular phrase that reminds you of a particular behavior, that's very helpful. So it can be very helpful to kind of almost program yourself with certain phrases that will remind you until the behavior becomes second nature. So I think, you know, Yes Sound is very powerful in that way.
I want to also talk to you about mandating dissent, which is a concept that you bring up. Mm. And I want to talk to you in the context of I found an improv phrase from the Second City Almanac of Improvisation. And inside this book, there are a number of just these adages that have been collected over the years. We don't even know who said all of them, but I found one that I thought connected. And here's the phrase. It says, "We can handle conflict or disagreement if it is all contained within a larger overall agreement between the players. Do not argue just to argue, and find the solution if you must disagree."
I like that. I like that a lot. Absolutely. Yeah, and the reason why it's helpful to mandate dissent goes back a little bit to what we were saying about that desire to form in group. You know, we like being with people who feel like us. We're drawn to people who feel like us. And so it's really easy to end up in a situation where you've got an amazing team of fantastic people and you've got a real risk of groupthink because you're not really challenging where mm-hmm. your ideas are going. And you know, we know that this is something that happens in groups, that you know, we each have cognitive blind spots. And if you're in a group, you can end up with an enormous blind spot if you are, you know, all used to taking decisions in a certain way. So mandating dissent is a really gorgeous way of bringing that sort of counter into the room, because you can say, for example, okay, so we're about to say yes to this idea that we all love. Let's go around the room and have everybody say, what's the one thing that could go horrendously wrong? You know, you can even do it as a pre-mortem and say, it's 5 years' time. This mm-hmm. was a disaster. What was it that took it down? And by, as you say, creating that sort of that space, that right to express the alternative view, you really improve your thinking. Even if you end up going ahead with the same idea, mm-hmm. you probably have made some refinements that have made it a better, more robust way of taking things forward.
The director, Mick Napier, sort of legendary improv director, theater director here in town, started doing a thing in rehearsals at Second City that he called Taboo Day. And the idea was you needed to bring in a scene idea or improvise or a written scene that we'd never agree to put on the stage. It could never go on the stage. And invariably, like 80% of those scenes ended up in the show.
I love it. That would work really well at work as well.
Can you imagine? Would.
Yeah. So everybody bring their taboo idea that is clearly disastrous.
Yeah. Yeah. And because, you know, it's like, well, OK, I got nothing to lose and I'm not going to get in trouble. Yeah. And then everyone's like, wow, no, that's actually pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, 90% of that is clearly bonkers. But,
yes.
You know, here's 10%. That's kind of interesting.
Let's play with that. Yeah. 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 Towards the end of the book, you have a section which is literally titled How to Be Good at Email. And I actually wanted to share a quick story with you because I thought you would find it interesting. Mark Sutton, who's one of our lead facilitators for the Second City Works, working with all different kinds of corporate clients, he was running a fairly high-profile workshop, and he was doing some storytelling work that focused on editing and getting to the core of the story. And the inevitable question about email came up, and one of the attendees in the workshop mentioned that they were married to someone currently working in the White House in a fairly big position. And she said that when you brief the president, you have to come with a 1-minute version, a 3-minute version, and a 5-minute version, because you never know how much time he'll have. And she's adopted that format to her emails. So the subject line is the 1 minute, the body of the email is the 3, and the attachment is the 5 minute.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We so many times we write emails as if they're kind of little thought pieces. You know, I've got this problem and we're thinking about this and that and I think this is what we're going to do. And
mm-hmm. Yes.
Absolutely. Rather than saying, we're going to do this because this is the issue we've run into and these are the options and this is why this is the best way forward. Absolutely. I mean, and you never know, right? You might just get time to say the headline, in which case you want to be really clear what your headline is. And I think also leading with the solution is it's something which is a tiny bit counterintuitive. It's a bit like it's a little in the spirit of yes, of the positive no, is to think, you know, you, of course, have gone through this sort of incredibly intense process of dealing with this problem, thinking it through, and then actually coming to the answer. And when you tell a story, it can be exciting to lay things out like that. It can be exciting to say, you know, in the arc of the narrative, situation, complication, resolution. But when you're writing an email, that's not really the right format for storytelling. It's much better to say, here's what I think we should do, or here's the punchline right up front. It's not it's not necessarily great comedy, but it's probably good communication for every day.
It ends up being good comedy too, because I mean, you know, when you see an email and there's just this huge block of writing, you are not reading it then, and you likely are not reading it closely when you do get to it.
Yeah. You know, sometimes I write emails and I just think, oh, this is getting a bit long. You know, if I'm spending a long time really, you know, crafting sentences, I often use that as a bit of a warning sign to say, is there a really short version of this that you're missing?
Yes.
And you're just using this to get clear on your thinking.
Yes.
And it's often the case that that's what I'm doing, and in which case I delete most of it and then just leave the shorter bit.
Yeah.
Often to suggest let's have a call or a conversation, actually.
Right. Get to talking. We were just talking about this before. I was reading a study that Nick Epley and his colleagues at the University of Chicago had done on communication and how people think that other people are smart. And the study revealed that it was people speaking and just speaking in their authentic voice was the most successful mode. It was not the same words written down. And then adding visuals didn't help, actually hindered it. It was a person speaking in their own voice. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense.
That totally makes sense. I mean, again, back to this point about when someone's brain is on the defensive, it's not able to perform as well because it's busy launching a fight, flight, or freeze response. And, you know, your brain has a certain amount of mental energy and it's limited, and there's going to be less to go around if you're busy thinking about defensive response. So, of course, you know, if you're slightly on edge because you're trying to be something you're not, it's much harder to be as brilliant as you can be if you're feeling relaxed. So that makes perfect sense to me. Absolutely.
You know, and it's connected to when you write that clarity is strangely calming, and that's because people's brains treat ambiguity and uncertainty as a threat.
Yeah, it's interesting, especially, you know, interesting in improv where you're especially, you know, you're creating situations which are deliberately uncertain and ambiguous, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what we do know is that it's helpful. I mean, you see this in PTSD treatment, that it's helpful to focus on the things that people do control and the things that they do know, because then it's easier to embrace the things that feel out of one's control. And I guess in a good improv setting, you've got a sense of trust with people. You know that nothing terrible is going to happen. You know that they're not going to try and make you look dumb. And, you know, if you have those really big things that you're sure of, it's much easier to then handle the things that, you know, you can't possibly be sure of, because that's the whole point of improv.
Right. And that you need to be working with specifics. Don't ask questions. Don't leave things open-ended. Where am I? Who am I? What am I?
Kind of rules of the game. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you know some of that, and of course, you know, this translates beautifully into thinking about how you handle things at work. You know, if you're in a situation where your organization is going through a big reorganization and it's really, you know, lots of uncertainty about your job and so forth, it really helps to say, okay, what do I know for certain? What am I sure about? What do I control? What is familiar to me in that situation? I mean, these questions are so helpful when you're facing really fluid situations that are making you feel uncomfortable.
And we're not, I mean, it strikes me that most people in work, leaders and others, organizations, we're not good to our brains. We expect too much of them.
Yeah, well, I think that's sort of a meta theme of the book, really, is to say, you know what? You can't turn a crappy day into an extraordinary one necessarily, but if you understand a little bit more about how your brain works and what conditions are needed for it to be at its best, then you can probably make every day, well, I don't know, let's pick a random number, 10% better. You can probably make things consistently slightly better. And actually, you know, that adds up to an enormous amount. If you recognize that, you know, you're going to do better thinking if you do step away from whatever problem it is you're trying to solve occasionally. If you know that actually you're more likely to have insight if you take a moment to reflect for 30 seconds on what it is you've just been hammering away at, these are things that take almost nothing to build into your day. And, you know, suddenly they boost your performance. And, you know, there are all sorts of things like that. If we just understand a tiny bit more about how the brain functions, you know, small changes can have enormous effects on how things feel day to day.
So we end the podcast by asking our guest for a yes and story. So, you know, in your life and your work, at any point, you know, you're saying a lot of no's, and a lot of those no's are right, and you hopefully are doing them in a positive manner. But there's got to be somewhere along the way where you didn't say just yes, you said yes and to something. Do you have one of those for us?
I have a lot.
Good.
Yes. So let me tell you one particularly corking yes and.
Mm-hmm.
There was in the run-up to the London 2012 Olympics, there was a real push to try and get volunteers involved as much as possible in running the thing, and that included in the performances for the opening and the closing ceremonies. And there was an open call for people to step forward and audition.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband and I decided to have a go. We both like singing.
Mm-hmm.
I like dancing as well, and he likes acting as well. And, you know, to be clear, we're amateurs.
Mm-hmm.
But we thought it would be fun to have a go. We both did okay in the first audition. And then after that, you get filtered off into different second auditions that are supposed to play to whatever you did particularly well at. I overperformed on the dance task in the first audition. I just looked a little bit too comfortable. And I turned up for my second audition, and you didn't know what it was before you turned up. You
mm-hmm.
know, so some people, you know, would turn up and they would suddenly discover that they were doing drumming.
Mm-hmm.
I turned up and I found myself in a professional dance audition.
Mm.
There were 200 people in the room, and 195 of them were professional dancers.
Mm.
And there were about five of us who were clearly in the wrong place.
Yeah.
We knew we were in the wrong place because there was a routine that we had to learn within, you know, not very large number of minutes, which involved, they were saying, well, if you can't do three pirouettes, just do a single one.
Yeah, okay.
And so my yes and was, you know, this building panic as I got closer and closer to the front of the room where I had to do this routine in front of everybody. It was to Adele's Rolling in the Deep. I'll never forget it. And at every moment, I wanted to run from the room. I was so terrified. I was so mortified. And I thought, okay, my yes and is to say, yes, you're terrified. Yes, this is a disaster. Yes, you should not be here. And wouldn't it be interesting to go through with this?
Yes.
So I did. I did. I went through with it. I had to do this routine in front of a panel of five judges, a room full of 195 dancers. And I sat down at the beginning of the routine. We were on our knees at the beginning of the routine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was giggling. I just thought, this is hilarious. This is going to be a good story. And I was also thinking, you know what? It's great to feel this out of my depth. I'm supposed to help people in thinking about how to be at their best.
Right.
You know, isn't it wonderful to think just how ill-equipped I am to deal with this,
mm-hmm.
and how useful it is to inhabit that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I did. And I ended up getting a part, not in a proper... Yeah, it was a sort of dance troupe. It wasn't a proper dance troupe. I ended up performing in the closing ceremony in this in a section which was mostly glorified twirling. There was no real dancing, but still, it was worth sticking it out.
That's the best story ever. Caroline Webb, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.